Good morning, everybody. My name is Larcine. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. And I came into Al-Anon June the 6th of 1981. So, and I want to thank the committee and everybody for having me here. It's a real honor and a privilege to get to be here. My badge says I'm in AA. I know the only requirement for membership is a desire to quit drinking. I don't know that I have that, basically, because I don't really remember when my last drink was, but I could probably figure it out if I needed to, and I don't know when my next drink is going to be. But I tell you, I qualify for Al-Anon because I have a sincere desire for a lot of you to not drink. So very, very sincere, which is why I am here. It is a real honor and a privilege to get to be here. There are just remarkable people here that mean a lot to me personally over the course of the time that I've been in the program. Those of you who have the friends that you meet in these rooms, it's just an indescribable thing. It just absolutely is. And I'm not just talking Al-Anon, I'm talking Alcoholics Anonymous too. This front row and people over here have touched my heart and my life, and I have a shot at a good life, apparently a great life, because I know them. And it's just a really big deal for me to get to be here with them this weekend. And my sponsor is here too, Carol, who loves me unconditionally despite myself, and Peggy, who's been an absolutely fabulous hostess and a very, very good friend as well. And then, of course, Peggy and Dick, who I love, and Gary, and just, again, I just love Cornhuskers. It's just, you guys are just absolutely wonderful here. I love Nebraska. It's pretty cool. You guys are looking a lot like Hawaii, though, when you fly in, I'm telling you. I mean, it was just like, whoa, like going to an island, and it's pretty tropical as well. You guys ought to start hiking up your prices to Hawaii stuff. Anyway, I've had a great, great time. I've enjoyed myself. I always get a little nervous before I talk, basically, because it's kind of intimidating sometimes being the Al-Anon speaker at an AA conference. You know, it's kind of like being a corpse at an Irish wake. Nobody expects you to say much, but they can't have the party without you. Al-Anon, the secondary program, everybody's like, I know somebody in Al-Anon. Oh, okay, good for you. It's like your charity work or something, We can't all be alcoholic, I'm sorry. Somebody has to hold the world together while you guys are thinking about what you're going to be doing. But I do want you to know I love alcoholics and I love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I love Al-Anon. And I'm very, very grateful that this conference, takes the time to have Al-Anon participation in it as well. I understand very well that our programs are different, different programs. There's Al-Anon and that's Al-Anon and there's Alcoholics Anonymous and there's Alcoholics Anonymous. But I am really, really grateful that when we have conventions like this, that we are, as my sponsor loves to say, we got sick together. Isn't it great that we can celebrate getting well together? And I think it's great we can come together at these kinds of things and share that recovery. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what it's like for me now, and what happened, how's it going? Hey, here I am. But anyway, I'm the oldest of four kids. My dad's a master sergeant in the Army, so that made me automatic corporal in my family. I've always had rank. It just is a gift I have. My husband jokes that I came out of the womb carrying a clipboard and wearing an armband, and he's not too far off the mark. It's just who I am. I've always been, when I was a kid, I was always in school. I was always room monitor, cafeteria monitor, playground monitor. And why? Because the teacher knew if she left and anybody misbehaved, I would report them. I would write their name down and they would be reported. I don't know what to tell you. It's a gift I have. I'm very, very good at it. It's just what I do. Even today, even though I have done a lot of work in that, I'm very close with my higher power today, my God today, and I pray every day for a lot of people. I also have another list, and those are the people that I report to God as well. There's the people I pray for, and there's the people I report, because there's some behavior going on. I know God cannot possibly see this, and he needs me to let him know that this behavior is going on, just in case he missed it, because he's busy with a lot of other people. And then when I came to Al-Anon, boy, I thought it was about having to change everything about you. What I've really come to learn in Al-Anon, it's about you're supposed to embrace who you are. It's about, to thine own self be true. those, it's really important. Keeping the truth in front of me is one of the most precious gifts I've gotten here. But you know, it's okay to be me. You know, it's just fine to be me. But it's when I try and take who I am and my personality and the way that I think and the way that I do things and push them on other people that it becomes an issue. You know, because if it's okay to be me, then it's okay to be you too. And that's, you know, to me, that if I have to sum up Alan on, that's just what it is. It's about really total unconditional love for each other. That's really what it is. That means I love you unconditionally. There's not a darn thing you can do about it. It also means, though, that, you know, if you have unacceptable behavior, you have unacceptable behavior, and I don't have to tolerate that either, but it doesn't mean that I don't love you. It doesn't mean that I don't love you, and I'm so, so grateful to have that in my life because it does give me the shot at a good life, potentially a great life. And that's really what's happened to me since I've come into these rooms. You know, what I really know is my life circumstances haven't changed that much, but what has changed is my how I look at things. You know, attitude is absolutely everything here, as, you know, Peggy has talked about, you know, as Steve has talked about, as Edith has talked about, and I know as Bob has talked about, and everybody else is going to talk about as it goes on. You know, it's just about what are you doing with what you got? You know, and you can sit there and be miserable about it, or you can look at the good part of it. You know, and nowhere else do you go when you come and talk about, you know, disasters and whatever, that you come and people laugh here about it. There's no other place. You know, go tell your disasters to people at work or whatever, and they'll just be sorry right along with you, you know. Well, you can watch TV and see that kind of stuff going on all day, but here they laugh about it when you're having a problem, which makes you, what? You know, and know you belong. Know you belong, because it's just looking at it at a different way. Like I say, I'm the oldest of four kids. My dad's a master sergeant in the Army, and so I grew up with a lot of discipline in my family. My dad ran our family just like he ran the Army, boy. I mean, we had little Army bunk beds that we slept in. We had Army blankets on them. We had little foot lockers at the end of our bed where our gear went. You know, that's the life I grew up with. I still remember standing at the end of my bed at attention, 4 years old, 5 years old, and my dad doing the room inspection, patting me on the head, open up the footlocker, telling me what I did wrong, how to make it better. You know, and it's just, again, what I grew up with, just a lot of, this is, you know, rules and regulations. And for me, I love them. They just really, really work well for me. I'm a rule and regulation person. I love it. I love written instruction. I love finding out what you expect me to do, how the best way to do it, and then just standing there at attention, you know, ready for the pat on the head and the salute or whatever I'm going to get. And it works for me. It doesn't work for everybody, but it, you know, it absolutely worked for me. It didn't really work so well for my sisters either, but it was a thing that I just kind of came out and, you know, knowing right out of the gate. But anyway, I'm growing up in this house. I mean, you know, my dad's also a drinker. My dad's a daily drinker. My dad gets drunk every day. I don't know that he gets drunk every day. I just know that he drinks every day. Now I know that he got drunk every day. But to me, it was just normal behavior in an alcoholic home. And if you grow up in a home where your dad drinks every day and gets drunk every day, it just becomes normal. How are you supposed to think that it's anything but that? And again, we were always living with other military families and military housings, and lots of dads got drunk all the time. And there were lots of moms walking around with black eyes and broken arms, and it was no big deal because that's just what I thought was absolutely normal behavior growing up in this deal. And when I was really new in Al-Anon, and still even today, I went to lots of open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new in Al-Anon, I cannot recommend that enough. It says in our Al-Anon literature that we should learn all we can about the disease of alcoholism, and I know no better place to learn that than in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was at one of these meetings with my husband one night, and the AA speaker that night, he talked about alcoholism, and he described it as being the family disease. And he described alcoholism, the family disease, as having a rhinoceros in your living room, but everybody pretends it's a coffee table. And if I have to describe the house that I grew up in, boy, that's the house that I grew up in, because there was all kinds of chaos going on the inside, but you'd never know it from the outside, not in a million years. And, you know, and if you grow up in an alcoholic home, you know one of the first things that goes out of the window is any form of verbal communication whatsoever. So, you know, if my mom, you know, she could tell when my dad was going to have one of his alcoholic explosions, so we'd be sitting at the dinner table, and of course she could never say to us, kids, okay, your dad's ready to blow, nobody do anything, because then my dad would blow. So she would talk to us facially, you know. So if you've, you know, if you're in an alcoholic home and you're at the dinner table and your mom's like, you know, I mean, you know what that means. If you are already, yeah, you know what that, so everybody looks down at their plate, nobody looks up, and you just hope this deal will blow over. And of course, if you've got an alcoholic that wants to explode, nothing is going to stop that from happening. And, you know, there'd be somebody as minor as a knife scraping a plate, and my dad would go ballistic, and everything would go flying, dishes, dinner on the floor, Things thrown against the wall. Everybody gets a whooping. Everybody's got to go to bed. My mom, the kids, the dog. I don't care what time it is. 5:30 in the afternoon is just the way it goes down in our house. And then the next morning I get up because I got to go to school, and I get up the courage to go down the hallway into the kitchen, and there's my dad drinking his breakfast beer, and it's, good morning, what do you want for breakfast? And no one says, gee whiz, what was that about last night, Dad? Gee whiz, how come you had to hit everybody? How come you had to break everything? You just, the rhinoceros just goes back to being a coffee table. And pretty much day in and day out, that's just kind of the deal that went on. You know, and I'm a product, you know, of the 50s. You know, I was born in the 50s and just growing up in that. And, you know, and what happened in your house stayed in your house, boy. And my dad was an absolute crazy lunatical guy. I mean, he was always doing things that the neighbors noticed. I mean, there was just no getting about that. But what you learn as a kid about that is that you just get in a lot of fights with the neighbor kids because you got to defend your dad, you got to defend your family, you got to defend your family name, your honor, and all that. And that's all the army stuff that I learned from my dad. I don't know that all of it was bad or whatever. I just know that he gave me what he had to give me. And that's just, to me, just so typical of everything that went on. And of course, my dad got progressively worse, as, you know, alcoholics do, and a lot of things happened in my house, and I'm not going to tell you this big horror story more or less than what anybody else went through. But, you know, my dad had a big issue with having girl children, and he just made us feel bad most of the time. And I always wondered why someone would go to all the trouble to marry someone, have kids, and then make everybody feel miserable about who they were or what they were and call them bad names. I could never quite figure that out, and I never knew about tying it to the alcoholism because I'm a little kid. This is just what's going on in my house. So I need to tell you that my dad died. He died when he was 55 years old. He died the disease that they talk about in the big books of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, Total Insanity and Death. I'm not even going to tell you the last words my father said to me. They were so vile and so vulgar, I'm not even going to repeat them from this podium. You know, what I know is what the disease of alcoholism, those were the last words the disease of alcoholism said through my dad to me, but of course I didn't know that at the time. And by then my mom had divorced him and I was the oldest, so all his care and everything had fallen to my responsibility. I've been taking care of him for the last couple of years. And of course he's full blown and just awful and dying from the disease of alcoholism. And I remember when the doctors came out and told me that my dad had passed away, my sisters and I are standing there and we're like, ding dong, the witch is dead, da da da. You know, and I don't mean to tell you this because I'm proud of it. I tell you this is because this is where the family disease of alcoholism took our family, that we were so great, you know, this, like, the reign of terror was over. That's the way we looked at it. You know, that's just how my dad was, his violent nature. It was just like, good, he's done, gone, he can't hurt us anymore. And, you know, and I had just started to come to Al-Anon. My dad died, you know, I started coming to Al-Anon in June of 81, and my dad had passed away October the 13th of 1981. So June, July, August, September, October, 4 months. I wasn't to the loving and kind portion of this program by any stretch of the imagination. Not whatsoever. But I had a lot of deals with my dad. But I really, really believed that when he died, it was done. It was just done. And I did a lot of work about things that happened as a kid, you know, and I did all the writing and I did all the step work that my sponsor had asked me to do. And it didn't seem to matter how much work I did about it. It got worse. It's like any time I would think about something he did or something he said or whatever feelings would come up, I would just get so angry all over again. And just, I don't know how you are, but if I'm really pissy and moany and just having a miserable time, I love to take that home and share that with the people I love and care about the most. Just keep that, you know, that gift, keep on giving it right on through the family. And I remember one day talking to my sponsor, and then my sponsor was Jeannie about it. And, you know, Jeannie said, you know, you did everything I asked you to do about this, she goes, in the program. She says, but, you know, there, you know, Al-Anon isn't about the problem. We all know the problems. You know, she says, Al-Anon is about a solution. And we need to put you in a solution mode here. So she says, I'm going to give you an assignment, you're not going to like it. And Jeannie prefaced it with, you're not going to like it, because I never liked anything they've ever told me to do in Al-Anon. It always sounds so stupidly wussy, you know, and just like, really? That's it? Let go and let God? Really? That's how you do it? Keep it simple? Uh-huh. You know, I mean, it's just like there's like more. There should be more. Like, let go and let God. My question is, what? What's God going to do? You know, I want to know that the other part of that. And so anyway, she said, I want you to go home and I want you to think about a good thing your dad had done. And my initial reaction was that there's no such thing, because what I know about the negative family disease of alcoholism is that there isn't anything good going on. That's what the negative family disease of alcoholism wants you to think all the time. Your life is a piece of crap, and you don't deserve it, and everything is horrible. I mean, that's just in a nutshell to me what the family disease of alcoholism wants you to keep thinking all the time. And I was a good student of that. And, you know, and I told her I didn't think there was a good thing my dad had done. But one thing I am so, so grateful for is for whatever reason, you know, when I started coming to Al-Anon, I did hear the part about you have to be willing. You have to have some willingness if you expect anything to change in your life. So I had some willingness. Mind you, it wasn't very much, but I did have some. And so, you know, I was willing to go home and think about it. And I don't know how long it took, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And then I remembered that my dad had taught me how to drive. And if you're going to marry an alcoholic of your own and live in Southern California, it is a skill you simply must have. You know, I mean, you just got to have that skill. And so, you know, and I didn't think it was a very good answer, and I certainly didn't think that she would think it was, a, you know, a good enough answer. But if you have a sponsor like I have had been sponsored in this program, I mean, you know, sponsors, you know, they want you to do good for a lot of reasons. First of all, it makes them look good, you know, so, I mean, you know, you win, they win. It's just a win-win situation here. But I went to her and I said, you know, I came up with something, and she was thrilled, absolutely thrilled. Oh, if we sat down, tell me. I go, you know, he taught me how to drive, which I thought she was just going to be so depressed and so disappointed in my answer. Instead, I got just the opposite reaction. You think I'd come up with the cure for cancer or I was going to win the Nobel Peace Prize or something. Because again, you know, sponsors, you know, they want you to do well. They sincerely want you to do well. And so she was jumped. That's great. That's wonderful. Because what I didn't know now was, besides, you know, this assignment, you know, if your sponsor gives you an assignment, trust me, there will be part two to this assignment. You know, I mean, you think you can get through one. Well, there's part two. And then she gave me part two. She says, that's all we need to start. She goes, now whenever you think about the stuff your dad said to you, when you think about the things that make you feel bad about who you are and what you are, she says, I just want you to take that negative thought and just replace it with this good one. Just replace it with this positive thought. You know, and she went on to tell me, you know, your dad is a sick alcoholic. He did the best that he could, but he was very plagued with the disease of alcoholism. The crap that came out of his mouth is the crap that came out of his mouth. But if you can see past that and separate the disease from the person, then just maybe, you know, maybe you can have the shot at a good life if you want to have it or not. But if you want to live in the misery about a bunch of stuff that you can do nothing about anymore, it is over if you will let it be over. And then just move on and think about your dad and the person he might have been if he had been able to get sober, if he wasn't an alcoholic. And, you know, and I don't mean to stand before you and tell you a lot of horrible things happened to me as a kid at the hands of my dad and that my sponsor gave me this little weenie assignment and now everything's just okie-dokie because I did this little weenie thing in Al-Anon. I'm here to tell you that my sponsor gave me a very precious gift. She gave me the gift of forgiveness. And never underestimate the power of it. It says in our literature that forgiveness is no favor. We do it for nobody but ourselves. And see, I thought if I forgave my dad, I'd be letting him off the hook. And I wasn't going to let him off the hook because he was the dad and I was, you know, the kid and it wasn't fair and whatever. You know, and if you want to hang on to that anger and you want to hang on to the resentment, you know, you don't even need to be in these rooms to do that. I'm pretty good at doing that without any instruction or steps whatsoever. And but I had to come in here to learn, you know, that if I want to have the shot at a good life, then those are the things that I get to do. You know, and I don't believe that my dad wanted us to think we were horrible people. I believe my dad was a very, very sick person afflicted by the disease of alcoholism. I think of him dying at the age of 55, and, you know, and I'm now 57. My dad was already dead 2 years. Already dead 2 years. I mean, and he died with all of his children being glad he was dead. How much more are you supposed to punish somebody? I do not know. But when my dad had passed away, my dad was a World War II veteran. He was a Korean War veteran. He was decorated. He served with distinction for 20-something odd years in the military. And so when he died, he was cremated, and they brought me his ashes. And there was a big military deal, and then, you know, a duty squad came over with his ashes, his medals, the flag. They gave me all that stuff. I happened to be home all by myself that day. My husband wasn't there. My sisters weren't with me, and they gave me all that stuff. And so I took my dad's ashes, and I put them in the garage, and I put them on a shelf, and I said, you sit here, and you think about what you did. And he sat there for a long, 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 long time. Long time. Long time. A lot of things to think about for Dad there. And just the way it went down, and until my sister finally rescued him, whatever. And that's another whole long story I'm not even going to go into because that's her sickness. But anyway, this is just the really ridiculous house I grew up in with ridiculous stuff going on. And I learned as a young kid, You know, you just don't ask questions. Just figure it out yourself to the best of your ability, because you can ask a question and get a good answer. You can ask a question and find yourself across the room. And you never know from day to day, minute to minute, which kind of deal it's going to be. So I need answers to stuff because I am a figure outer, and but I don't talk to people about nothing. I just learned a long time ago, I just think crap up. I just think it up, floating up in the universe, lands here, becomes fact for me, and I act upon it. You know, that's just pretty much, you know, even today I will catch myself many times functioning that way. You know, so when my dad got out of the Army, we moved to California. Now, up until this time, you know, I'm a teenager. We lived in Europe and all up and down the East Coast and, you know, a little bit of, you know, the middle part of America. But, you know, for the most part, we were on that side. And then my dad gets out of the Army and we move to California. You know, and this is in the late 60s. And there's no rules and discipline in California at all. You know, so I'm like a fish out of water there, you know, because what I am is I am a straight A student. I'm a good girl. I do exactly what I'm supposed to do. I keep my nose clean and stay out of the sarge's way and do exactly every instruction the sarge gives me to do. And I'm just dating little weenie guys that are just as weenie pencil pushing as I am, you know, geeky dudes. And, you know, it was really hard to date in my house. My dad had a lot of rules and regulations about dating. We had to bring home these little weenie guys to meet my dad. My dad is over 6 foot tall. He has one eyebrow. He can raise 6 inches off of his forehead. He looks like Satan himself standing there all the time. I tell you, he's just a scary looking dude. And he would tell, you know, we'd bring these little weenie guys home, you know, to go out on a date with us. And my dad would sit him in the chair, ask him where we were going, what time we were going to be home, and then what part of their anatomy he would remove if we were not returned in the virginal condition of which we left the house in the first place. Very, very hard to get a second date in my house. Damn near impossible. Guys would bring us home early, shake our hands at the door, thank you, but nobody's worth this. You know, that would be the deal. And apparently not. And that's the way I remember it until my sisters reminded me, you know, that, you know, yeah, Dad was very intimidating all by himself, but the fact that he always had a hand grenade or a sidearm didn't help matters either. You know, now again, when you know, my dad was always going to blow up the neighbors with a hand grenade or blow up the milkman or whoever was pissing him off that day. And when you grow up with that kind of behavior, it becomes normal behavior. You know, I just didn't think anything about it anymore. And that's why I have no qualms with being the non-drinker, being the non-alcoholic, how we become sick too. Because when you are subjected to that kind of crazy behavior all the time, it says in our literature, when every good sense tells you there's something wrong with the alcoholic's thinking, you know, you still act like it's okay, like there's going to be some kind of reason thing that's going to come out of here. You know, and I have to defend my dad's behavior to the neighborhood kids and things who are telling me, your dad's crazy, your dad was, you know, he's there. Because my dad, there's always police activity in our house. That happened all the time. It was absolutely no big deal to me. But that's the way I remember it. So the fact that, you know, that yes, he was always had a sidearm, he always had a hand grenade. His last job in the Army, he was in ballistic missiles, and he stole some solid rocket fuel. Just because he could, I guess, and he said it was old stuff. They weren't even going to use it anymore. And I tell you, that's how he lit our barbecues for years and years and years. He saw off a little piece of it, throw it in there. Remember those big boy barbecues that kind of had the lid thing, you know, that side half lid thing on there? I mean, he's launched more barbecues in, you know, when he almost got to the top of the garage. He put a little bit too much in at that time, but you know, it's just, again, when you grow up in that, that's just normal. That's just no big deal at all. I think I was well out of the house and married before I found out you could have barbecue chicken that wasn't black. I didn't even know it existed. So, anyway, that was just the craziness. So when I was 17 years old, I met my husband. I should have known there was something really wrong with him because my dad liked him right away, and that never, ever happened. And I went on this date with Butch, and Butch is several years older than me. I was like 17. He's like 24 years old. He'd been married once before, had a kid, back living with his mom and dad. Could have been clue number two to me that he was alcoholic, but that went right over my head. And I remember we're going to go over to his house, and we were with this other couple, and he stops at a liquor store, and he asked me what I would like to drink. Well, I'm 17 years old, and there's rules and regulations about drinking in the state of California. And I tell him what those rules and regulations are, you know, and I know he heard what he still hears today when he doesn't want to hear what I'm saying. He heard blah, 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 because he went in and got a gallon of Red Mountain wine, if nothing to impress me, what he can consume in sheer volume alone in one evening. So anyway, we go back to his house with this other couple, and I don't drink. It's against the law to drink. I would never even think about doing such a thing. But we're going to play a game. And And it's a legitimate board game. It was called Pass Out. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of it, but there really is this game. They've actually made a board game. And it has rules because I read them. And now I don't drink, but, you know, I have a whole slew of rules. I just do. It's just the way I am. I have an index card of everything that goes on in the world in my head. And now I don't drink, but I have another rule that I must win every game I play. So, you know, I'm going to have to give up on the drinking thing if I'm going to honor the I win every game I play thing. So anyway, so I had a half a glass of wine. I won the game. That's what that was all about. And then I remember him, you know, taking me home. Now, he's had considerable amount to drink compared to my little weenie half a glass of wine. You know, he's just about polished off most of that bottle by himself. Now he's getting ready to take me home, and obviously, you know, he's been drinking a lot or whatever. And I want you to know I'm 17 years old right now. You know, boy, I've got an index card in my life about how my life is going to be and who I'm going to marry and what's going to be going on. And believe you me, I'm not going to be married to anybody like my dad. I mean, you can cut the hate in my house with a knife. I mean, nobody ever wants to be there. I mean, our house is the only house on the block where kids can't wait to go to school. I mean, it's just get me out of here. And so, you know, and definitely on this list on my card, boy, I'm not going to marry anybody like my dad, who drinks like my dad, who is mean like my dad. I am not going to have any of that going on. Yet here I go out with this guy, and right out of the way, there's an attraction that was just undeniable from the very, very beginning. Probably because most alcoholics have such potential that Al-Anons just cannot resist it. I mean, it's like, it's just unbelievable magnetic pull or something going on there. But even though he had drank all this stuff, and even though it was obvious to me that he was drunk, you know, it was, you know, I will adjust the information how I need to adjust it, because I did have this attraction. But what I really discovered was that, you know, where my dad is so angry and so violent and so verbally abusive, when my husband drinks, he's just the complete opposite. He just wants to hug you and kiss you, tell you how pretty you are. I mean, it was just a totally different experience for me. And I can work with that, okay? I know I can do something with this, you know. And so pretty much from that point on, we just started dating pretty exclusively, just he and I. And it was really hard for me to date Butch, basically, because he couldn't remember my name. But you can't let a little thing like that stop you from dating an alcoholic, now can you? Not if you're really going to go get one. And I know my name is different. Edith was asking me about, you know, where it came from. And my dad named me Larcy. And, you know, and again, my dad had a lot of issues with having girl children, very, very shameful for him. But I was firstborn. This gave me a lot of perks, being firstborn. So because I was firstborn, my dad named me Larcine, which he said was the name of a town in Scotland, because my dad was hugely, hugely proud of his Scottish heritage. I don't think there's anything he was more proud of than that. And so because I couldn't be a boy, he would give me, but I was firstborn, I got the name of this town in Scotland. He always telling me how proud I should be of that name. And so, you know, after my dad has died, I've been Al-Anon for a while, I get curious about Larcine, Scotland, and so I go to the library. This is way before computers and Google or any of that stuff. We have places called libraries that have books, and so I went to the library, and I tried to look up Larcine, Scotland, but to no success. And so I asked the reference librarian, you know, who has, you know, a lot more resources, you know, with the big library in L.A. at her disposal, if she would, you know, research it. I gave her the information. She told me to come back in a week or two. I did. Never been Larcine, Scotland. It just doesn't exist. So now I'm getting ticky, you know. This is just like, one more time, you know, it's a big fat lie from my dad. Thank you very much. And so I'm getting a little bit angry about it, upset to say the least. And then my husband and I have a friend who's a very, very avid golfer. He goes to Scotland quite a bit. Apparently Scotland is the golf mecca of the universe. And so he said, you know, maybe there's not Larcine, Scotland now, but maybe there was Larcine, Scotland many, many, you know, hundreds of years ago. Scotland's a very old country. Let me check it out first. So he was gone for a couple weeks. He comes back from Scotland. No, nobody in Scotland has ever, ever heard of Larcine, Scotland. So now I'm really ticked. I'm going to change my freaking name. I'm done. You know, this is, again, a bunch of crap, and I'm getting madder and madder about it. And I happened to be at an AA meeting with my husband, his Saturday night meeting, and this AA friend of ours walks up to me, and he goes, Larcine, you are not going to believe this, but I found out that Larcine is a Scottish word. I am like, oh my God, you've got to be kidding me. He goes, yes, it is Scottish. For father was drunk when daughter was born, so daughter got a weird name. Now, I am pretty sure that that is not a true story. I am darn near sure about it. But, you know, what he went on to say to me is, you know, I'm alcoholic like your dad was alcoholic. You know, I know that for a fact. And he says, and I really believe with all my heart that your dad, however he read it or saw it, really believed when he gave you the name Larsine that it was the name of a town in Scotland. I don't know how he screwed it up. I don't know how he messed it up. But I know that that's what he believed. And because, you know, the gift isn't wrapped quite the way you think that it should be, are you going to let it not be a gift from him anyway, since you treasured it so much? You know, and left to my own devices, I'll change my freaking name and be mad at you, you know, until I meet you up in the pearly gates or whatever. You know, but one more time, when I take it to somebody else, you know, my circumstances, again, are not changed. It's just my attitude and how I look at it. And now I'm proud of my name. You know, and I know there's no Larsine, Scotland, but I'm always joking, if I ever win the lottery, I'm going to Scotland. I'm buying some little funky town, and man, I'm going to take Larsine, Scotland as fast as I can. Pop told me he's going. He knows he's going to find it. He's going in a couple of weeks. I appreciate that. I want the T-shirt. But anyway, so I start dating Butch. You know, and there's a lot of drugs and alcohol, and, you know, and drugs are really against all the rules and regulations. Oh my God, you know. But there's a lot of alcohol and stuff like that. But there was also a lot of fun. I mean, he's a fun guy to be with. I just had a ball. I always had such a great time. And why I know I had such a great time is because up until that point, until I met him, my life was so regimented. Oh my God, you know, everything was just so regimented all the time. I didn't know about doing things spontaneously. You know, it was just, you know, and he was just a fun guy. Let's go do this. Let's, on the spur of the moment, this, that, it didn't matter. It was just about having a good time. And I really, and we had a great, great time. But what ended up happening is after I dated him for a couple of years, I got pregnant. You know, I don't care if it's a big deal for you, huge deal for me. Because now I'd broken the big rule and the big regulation. And this, and my idea about this is when our life got really, really bad behind the drinking, it was because I'd broken this big rule and this big regulation, and this was the big punishment from above. You know, and I'm here to tell you I had to come down on a few years before I figured out that if you're going to screw around and not use any birth control, you might get pregnant, just a fact of life. But if you're blaming God for everything that's going wrong and you think that there's a punishing God who's out to get you, you know, then you might as well get on up and walk out these doors, because there isn't anything that can help you if that's the God you're working with. You know, if he wants to get you. You know, it's been my experience in Al-Anon and from people that I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that there is a loving God. And he doesn't really care what you've done or where you've been or how horrible things you've done. What he cares about is what you're doing right here, right now. And he wants you to be happy, joyous, and free. And if that means cleaning up that past, it's all doable. It is all doable. And he will put the people in your life and the steps and the people that you need to walk you through whatever it is you need to go to get there, to get to that place where you have a loving God in your life who you know is with you 150% no matter what's going on. That's another gift of this program that I can't be grateful enough for. But anyway, so Butch and I, you know, we have this child, and in actuality, I wasn't pregnant when I got married. The baby was 3 months old, but I wasn't pregnant when I got married. So if you asked me if I was pregnant when I got married, not on the day. Now, I wouldn't say not on the day. No, the day we got married, I was not pregnant. So you can all figure all that stuff out yourself. And like I say, you know, it was a big, big deal for me. Such a big deal for me, as a matter of fact, that when I was in Al-Anon in Southern California, we have our Al-Anon Family Groups Convention. In my very first year at AFG, we have our AFG convention, and we always get two adjoining hotel rooms, and we cram as many Al-Anons in these two adjoining hotel rooms as we can. And we're up in the room one night having the meeting after the meeting, and there's like seven of us in the room, and everybody's sharing their deepest, darkest secret, you know. And I'm, at least that's what I'm thinking they're sharing. I don't know that that's what they're sharing, but that's what I heard. So when it came around my turn, I'd shared with these, you know, other six ladies how I had to get married because I was pregnant. And seven women in the room, turns out six of them had to get married because they were pregnant. We decided the seventh was the sickest because she married an alcoholic and did not have to. I mean, I don't know why you would do that if you didn't have to, but, you know, and I got to learn that day, you know, you are as sick as your secrets. Because, see, where that was all taking me at that point was, you know, again, how I'm affected by the family disease of alcoholism is that, you know, that little boy that I had, you know, it got to the point that every time his birthday would roll around that I would blame that innocent little child for my situation. Because if I hadn't gotten pregnant with this kid, then I wouldn't have gotten married to this guy and I wouldn't have this crappy life. And I would blame an innocent little child for the choices that I was making, but this is the family disease of alcoholism. It just keeps you in the dark and keeps you having horrible, bad thoughts, and you don't run them past anybody. You just keep thinking up crap and putting it in here and then working upon that. And that's how the negative family disease of alcoholism affects me, and I'm not the person that's drinking. And anyway, you know, and up until that point, I'd never ever talked to Butch about his drinking, but the day after we got married, I sat him in the kitchen chair and I told him the rules and regulations of the marriage. And you know, I told him we could get a babysitter once a month, you know, but he's going to go to work, he's going to be a good guy, we're going to save money, we got a kid, we got responsibilities, do you understand the plan? He sat in the chair and did this, which I took as affirmative. What I know today, he was so drunk and loaded, he said he was just doing this thing, and he heard the blah, 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 blah part, because he did not come home. Day three of our marriage, he does not come home all night long. This is a huge violation of the rules and regulations. I have sat down. And man, I am not going to put up with it. I'm going to tell you here, I watched my mom do the silent treatment. It never worked. You know, I am proud to stand before you and tell you my husband begged for it, begged for the silent treatment. He never got it one time. I was like one of those little dogs, you know, when you walk in, just... He even says I talk as fast as I do because I only had so much time from when he came home to when he passed out to tell him everything it was that I was going to tell him. By God, he was going to hear it. Dang, it still just gets me all fired up thinking about it. Absolute craziness. Absolute craziness. Now, you know, I want you to know that absolutely, you know, the driving force behind Butch and I getting married was the fact that we had this child. There was no doubt about that. But I also want you to know I love my husband. I believe that he loved me. I believe, you know, we got married in a church in front of a minister. You know, he was sober the day we got married. You know, I believe, you know, that we were as sincere as two people can possibly be, you know, when they're making vows with each other, promising to love and cherish each other and take care of each other. I mean, I have absolutely no doubt that all of that was going on in our life. But what Butch didn't know and I didn't know was it wasn't just he and I that got married that day. It was also the family disease of alcoholism. And I'm here to tell you the family disease of alcoholism doesn't love or cherish anything or anybody. It means to tear your family apart through the alcoholic or the non-alcoholic. It's totally irrelevant to the family disease of alcoholism. You know, and then our life just pretty much, you know, just took off from there. His drinking and me doing everything to get him to stop drinking. I mean, just insane, just out of the get-go. And, you know, I remember him coming home one night, and he woke me up and demanded to have his dinner. You know, and this is like 3 o'clock in the morning, and he'd never done anything like that. He's usually a pretty easygoing guy, but he startled me, kind of, and his behavior was like my dad, and it really scared me. And I went in the kitchen, but then I woke up fully, and I remembered who he was dealing with. And I made a Mexican casserole that night that called for one jalapeno pepper, but I had a whole can full of those suckers in there, you know. So I chopped up everything, a lot of them, and stuffed them in there, and he ate it, and then he was doing what I wanted to do, which was be in the bathroom and puke his brains out. Because I don't know how you feel, but when my alcoholic throws up, oh my God, I just get a warm feeling all over. It just lasts me for days and days. It's just the best, just the best. And, you know, because again, this is where the family disease of alcoholism will take you in a very short amount of time, because that's what it becomes, you know. And it takes sweet, sweet love. Sweet, sweet love, and turns it into this garbage can of revenge and, you know, getting even, and I hide it all behind, you know, well, I'm doing what he's doing. I need to teach him a lesson. I need to show him, you know, and this is the negative disease of family, you know, the negative disease of alcoholism, that it would, you know, that it takes this sweet love and turns it into this piece of crap. And I don't even know that it's going on, because that's the lie. Because, you know, what ends up happening is my husband starts doing stuff. Now, in the beginning, it never seems so bad, but, of course, if it gets progressively worse, it does. You know, all of a sudden, he's spending entire paychecks in a weekend. I've got babies and diapers. I need the money for this stuff. You know, we're going to get kicked out of our apartment if we don't pay our rent. I don't understand how he can tell me how much he loves me and how much he loves our kids, and then he goes and does his behavior. You know, I don't understand it, because I don't understand the disease of alcoholism, and he doesn't understand the disease of alcoholism. And so because we don't know that our real enemy is the family disease of alcoholism, we take it out on each other, you know, and subsequently take little kids along on the ride too. You know, and this is just where the family disease of alcoholism gets to take the whole family. And I can go on and on about all the things that happen because, you know, as Peggy said, my husband, he's a busy guy. He's a busy guy when he's drinking and crazy, crazy thinking and all kinds of lunatical stuff going on. And as Steve said last night, you know, and none of it was funny when it was happening, you know, but now that you can look back and see the ridiculousness of the behavior, you know, then you can. My husband, if he were here and you asked him what kind of alcoholic he was, his word would be pig. That's his word, not mine, his description of it. And just to give you an example of that, One time I got these calls from his friends whom I affectionately referred to as scum of the earth people. They were the drug dealers and stuff like that, but his pals. And my husband was over at their house, and he was so drunk and so loaded that if I did not come get him, they, the drug dealers, were going to call the police. Okay, so I put on my cape and off I go. And I get there, and I'll never forget this because the drug dealers are looking through the Venetian blinds to see if I've gotten there. And he's in their bushes. They've already kicked him out of the house. So I get him out of the bushes, and I get him in the car. I take him home, we only had our one son then, and Bill was a baby. And so I took Bill and put Bill in his crib, came down to get my husband. Well, he's gotten out of the car without my help, and he's fallen on the street, hit his head on the curb. Blood is gushing out all over the place. You know, I'd like to tell you I'm concerned about him. I am not. My only worry is I don't want anybody to see him. You know, I just how it is. But he's 180 pounds of wet washcloth. There's no way I can pick him up. So I heave him up by the ankles, over the curb, drag him down the sidewalk, little trickle of blood falling behind his head, little trail we're leaving here. You know, and why do we call these people normies? I have not a clue. But this guy's driving down the street. I'm dragging a guy bleeding by the head down the street. He stops his car and says, "Are you having a problem?" That's what the normie people think. I go, "Yes, my husband's fallen and he can't get up." So the guy helps me get him up. And again, I've never had an injured husband. I need a card for that, you know. So it's just like, what do I do? Well, I got to, you know, he's injured. He must be in bed. Our bedroom is on the second floor. So not only do I have to get him in the house, I have to get him up a flight of stairs because he has a head injury and he has to be in bed. Again, information from nowhere. I got to do it once it's in here. So now, of course, we're talking back and forth, you know, the words are not very pleasant. And, you know, he's cursing at me and I'm cursing at him. We get to the top of the stairs and Mr. Good Samaritan no longer wishes to participate, you know. So that guy's out of the house like a shot, but he got Butch on the bed. Now there's a huge puddle of blood on the bed. Now I very, very, very much want my husband to die. I want to be a widow. I can taste it. It tastes so good. But I don't want my DNA or fingerprints anywhere around the crime. You know, I know he's going to do himself in sooner or later on his own. And so now I'm hysterical. I call 911. They don't know what's going on. They sent a hook and ladder truck. The police were there, paramedics. They even got a hold of my mom. I mean, it was a big mob scene in the house. And I'm in there with the baby. Oh, my husband, oh, blah, blah, blah. And the Redondo Beach police come in and they go, "Mrs. Gantner, your husband says he injured himself because you pushed him down a flight of stairs." And I told the police I didn't do that, but if you prop him up, I'll be happy to push him down right in front of the Redondo Beach police. Because that's just how it goes, right? More drama on top of more drama. They told me that wouldn't be necessary. They cleaned him up. He's got a little weenie cut. He only needs like 3 stitches, but he's too drunk to stand, so they got to take him by ambulance to the hospital. Now, I don't know how your neighborhood is. Friday, whatever time it was, 5:30, 6 o'clock, all my neighbors are out front because the paramedics are there and the hook and ladder truck and all of that. And Butch comes out on the gurney, and my husband is a super friendly guy. He knows the whole entire neighborhood. I speak to no one. But he comes out on the gurney, "Hiya, Frank, hiya, Joe," you know, and all that. And they're, "Butch, what happened?" "Larson pushed me down the flight of stairs." And, of course, they believe him. They believe him because all they ever see is easygoing drunk Butch and banshee screaming Larson, you know. And how do you explain that? So, again, I have no qualms with how we become sick, too, how we become so, you know, it says in our literature how we become irritable without knowing it. Why? Because we try and force solutions. And that's all. I was always taking my round husband and trying to fit him in a square peg and never knowing that I was dealing with alcoholism, never knowing, but just getting angrier and angrier and angrier and feeding the family disease of alcoholism. You know, it's just as bad as me as it was in my husband, without a doubt. And anyway, what ended up happening, you know, to make a long, long story short, you know, he ended up getting arrested for drunk driving, which is absolutely no big deal. He's been arrested lots of times for drunk driving, but that particular night he had a spiritual awakening. That was his deal. But I'd heard about this hospital that they had just opened, and I called them, and they said I could have my husband committed if I wanted, but that once he sobered up, if he didn't want to stay, they didn't want him because they were only interested in people that were interested in being sober. So anyway, after he got arrested, he always got released the next day because this was back in 1979. They just usually let you go the next day, and I picked him up from jail and brought him home. And then, you know, he made that understatement of the century. I think I may have a problem. And so I gave him the number of the hospital, and he made the call and made arrangements to go in there. And this is how I know God was working in his life and not in mine, because I just totally stepped out of it. I wasn't going to Al-Anon, didn't know anything about any of that stuff at that point. But I just stepped away, you know, and Butch made the arrangements, and he had to go into the psychiatric unit because he had been taking Valium for a million years and all the other drugs, and he'd gone through DTs before, so they wanted to have him in the psychiatric unit for a few days. And I remember getting to the end of the double doors and the guard letting me out after I dropped him off and him calling me back, you know, Larsine, come back, come back. And I went back to him, and he reached into his pocket and handed me the Valium that he brought in case of emergency. And he never parted with a Valium in his life, so I knew something was really, really different. And I went home and I took it because I was a flaming bastard. I think I slept like, 30 hours on one 10 milligram Valium. But in my own defense, I was very, very tired, okay? I was pooped. So anyway, so he's in there, and to cheer him up, then our boys at that point were in kindergarten and preschool. I would, you know, take him what they'd made in kindergarten and preschool to cheer him up, but no, he wanted to show me what he made in occupational therapy that day, you know. And I'd take it home, we'd hang it on the refrigerator. Look, Daddy's doing artwork. Okay, here we go. Don't know what it is, but it's supposed to be good. And, you know, and while he was doing all that stuff, you know, and then they introduced him to the alcoholic side of that thing, you know, and I'm proud to report to you, you know, my husband's been sober since that day. His sobriety date is July the 21st, 1979, and he's been sober 32 years this past July. And I really want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous from the bottom of my heart because you saved the life of a really good man, and I am so, so grateful for that. But beyond that, you really did help save the life of a family, too, because, you know, I really wanted to be a widow desperately. God, did I want to be a widow. I mean, you know, I'm like 23, 24, 25 years old. I got two little kids, you know, and I just, you know, somebody once said to me, why don't you just divorce him? And I'm like, and let him win? I don't think so. That's not going to happen. You're not walking out that door unless it's feet first, and that's just the way that's going down. But I want you to think about that really angry woman I had become, and I want you to think about those two little kids, and I want you to think if my husband had died and I'd gotten that wish come true, I want you to think what kind of family you think we would be today. Because see, to me, it's the family disease of alcoholism, and maybe the alcoholic is the catalyst that starts it off, but that is all it is. It's just the flick of the light, and then where I run with it from there, that's all on me. That's all on me. So anyway, so Butch got sober, and now he's like the big hero of the universe, and because that's how it is when they get sober, boy. And at least it was in 1979. They didn't know no family, nothing. They said, I should go to A. Al-Anon meeting. Now, I forgot to tell you, I'd gone to A. Al-Anon meeting before this. I'd gone there and sat in the front row, listened to all the Easy Does It, you know, merry-go-round named denial, understanding ourselves, you know, but I wanted the piece of literature that's how to get them to stop drinking and do what you want them to do. That's the piece I'm interested in, and they didn't have it. And so, you know, so I got nothing out of that meeting because, you know, even though I was sitting in that front row and I wanted my life to be different, Larsine, what are you willing to do about it? Absolutely nothing, because it's not my fault. You fix him and I'll be okay. So now, you know, this has been like a year and a half later and Butch gets sober and so they tell me I should go to A. Al-Anon meeting. So I go back to that A. Al-Anon meeting. I went right back to that same meeting. And they saved the last 10 minutes for the newcomers. So the last 10 minutes, I couldn't wait to raise my hand. I said, you know, I was here about a year and a half ago, and I asked you how to get my husband sober, and you didn't tell me how. And I'm not going to tell you how I got him sober now. And I sat down. And do you know what they said to me? You got that right. Keep coming back. And I want you to know. I want you to know, if you are in a meeting and someone tells you to keep coming back, that is because you've said the most ridiculously stupid thing. That's your only hope. That is the only hope you have, is if you keep coming back. You have no other hope, trust me. That's how far your head is up your you-know-what. And so anyway, and then of course, you know, my husband's sober, you know, and I'm not going to Al-Anon because I really believed he's sober, I win, game over, nanny, nanny, nanny. And then what ended up happening is my husband was sober a couple of years, and I loved his being sober. It was absolutely great. But I was sure when he was a good husband, I was going to be okay. I was sure when he was a good provider, I was going to be okay. I was sure when he was sober and he's a good dad, all those things were going to fix me. And 2 years into his sobriety, boy, I was anything but fixed. I was still a ranting lunatic because I just didn't know how to turn it off. And even though I loved it, you know, that he was in AA and everything was great, being around that did not fix me. It did not fix me. And what happened one day, you know, I'm on task. I'm an on-task person. I make lists all the time. I have days I do certain chores. It's just the way it works for me. It doesn't matter if it works for you. I'm comfortable that way. And, boy, that day I'm on task. And back in those days, boy, you do your chores first. You get everything done. But there's no fun until you're done. That's just how it goes. You know, it's just the way I was raised. It's just what you do. And I was on task for that day, and I'm doing the laundry. And my boys, of course, now are much, you know, a couple years older, and they're in the living room cutting up with their dad, laughing and carrying on. And, boy, I pass them through with the laundry, and I set foot in the living room, and there's dead silence because that's what I do. I suck the joy right out of a room right now. That's what I'm capable of. And as I pass through that room, I just heard this voice in my head, which I choose to say was my higher power, saying, boy, Larson, you've become your dad. You have become your dad. You don't have to drink a drop to be just exactly who your dad was. You know, and then the next thing I heard was, and this is not who I want you to be. This is not who you are supposed to be. So what I started doing was that I started going to Al-Anon, you know, and I'm so grateful because I didn't come to keep an alcoholic sober. He was doing fine on his own. I didn't come to get him sober. He was already there. You know, I came because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I'm a rule person and a regulation person, and they told me, you know, what do we do here? We go to meetings, we read the literature, we work the steps, you get a sponsor, we be of service, sign me up, I'm all over that stuff. I got a sponsor immediately. I wasn't looking for anybody just like myself. I'm always hearing an Al-Anon, oh, I'm looking for somebody just like me, that's why I don't have a sponsor now. Why do you want somebody just like you? Then she knows what you're thinking. That's not good. You don't want anybody who knows how you think. You know, so I got a sponsor the complete opposite of me. I got a sponsor that was older than my mother, who had never lived with sobriety. She was divorced from her alcoholic. She had no kids. She had a thick Dutch accent. She could hardly understand a bloody word the woman said. And I remember the first time I used her as a sponsor, my husband went out to work that morning, and he had a dead battery, and he asked me to jump it, and I did. And after I jumped it, he ran out of gas. And this made him angry, and he started yelling. So I don't take crap with no one. So he started yelling. I started yelling right back at him. He stormed off to work. I went upstairs, called my sponsor, and reported his behavior. And I am good at that. And when I got done telling her what had happened, she says, when Butch gets home, you tell him you're sorry for what you said and did. It was unkind and unnecessary. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Jeannie doesn't know how we do things in America. You know, and... And she missed the crucial who started it, which I always think is so important. And so I started telling her the story again, because obviously not listening to the details. And I just started telling her the story the second time. And, you know, I didn't even get a minute into it. And she says, don't tell me what you just told me. I heard you the first time. You know, and for what you said and did, you owe your husband an amends. And another thing, don't ever call me and start a conversation with Butch said or Butch did. I am not Butch's sponsor. I am Larsine's sponsor. And for what she said, it was unkind and unnecessary, and you need to tell him you're sorry. I'll see you at the meeting tonight. She hangs up on me. Click. End of conversation. We are done. I learned valuable lessons. Never call your sponsor first thing in the morning because you got all day long to think about what she told you to do. Not good for me at all, you know. Never call your sponsor when you're going to see her that night in a meeting because she's going to want to know if you followed direction. And I'm a rule follower. I got to do it. You know, but I don't put stuff off ever, boy. When Butch walked in the door that night, I marched right up to him and I said, I'm sorry I let your shitty attitude affect me the way that it did. And I'll try and do better in the future. Now, you know, for a long time I thought that probably wasn't a good amends. That was a great amends. I'm here to tell you that was a great amends because I'm here to tell you that was I was this much willing that day to do something a little bit different because it was always his fault. I was always willing to blame him for everything. And that day I was willing to take this much responsibility and get on the road and the journey, you know, that is Al-Anon, you know, that is about unconditional love, that takes us to this place where we will intuitively know what to do about those things that used to baffle us, that I will know, you know, when sincerely there is an amends that is due for me, you know, because what I've learned here is just to keep the truth in front of me. And that day, even though it doesn't sound like it was a big, big deal, it was a huge deal in our house because I'd never told him I was sorry for nothing. He couldn't even speak for, like, I don't know, the whole evening. Did you really say you were sorry? He kept telling me that. Did you really say you were sorry? You know, even though I had said it that way, he knew exactly what I was trying to do. And, you know, and pretty much, you know, my journey has just been that kind of a road, you know, just that kind of stuff that's just been going on this much at a time, every single day, to the best of my ability. You know, but, you know, I am who I am, you know, and I don't know anybody that comes here and gets the silver bullet that makes them impervious to everything or makes them, you know, work this program that's just perfect deal. It's not. It's about living life on life's terms, how it comes. You know, I am hardwired to think negatively. I am hardwired to overreact. I am hardwired to think the worst. I am hardwired for fear. That is just the way that it is. But what I have gotten here, you know, is just a different channel to go around. I run it by you guys. You know, and then things work out as they're supposed to when I run it by you guys. Then I got a shot at a good life, possibly a great life, you know, when I run it by you guys. You know, and to give you a couple of examples of that, you know, when I was like 15 years in the program, we have our South Bay Roundup, much like Cornhuskers is to you, the Roundup is to me. It's in my own backyard. You know, our Roundup is, you know, 20-something years old, and I've been involved with it since the very beginning. And we, this one particular Roundup, fabulous speakers, wonderful workshops, just, you know, all of our friends, so much love, so much serenity. And, you know, when I come home from a weekend like that, and, you know, I don't know how you guys are, but once I've been at a weekend like this, you know, it's like serenity and love and all the, you know, the program, all that stuff's like coming out of every orifice of my body. I'm like floating home, and I'm going to do this for the rest of my life and never be unhappy again, you know, and stuff. And at that point, our youngest son was 19 years old, and he was living at home having a lot of problems with drugs and alcohol, and very fearful for this kid, because what's the worst that can happen? They can die, and it does happen. It's absolutely the worst thing that can happen, but it can happen. And, you know, so I have a huge, huge fear about this. And but anyway, I come home, and I'm very disciplined in my exercise deal, you know, and now I've been at the Roundup for 3 days, which means I have missed exercise for 3 days, which means I must do 3 days of exercise in 1 day. That's just how it works for me. It doesn't have to work that way for you. But so I've got to do all this stuff in 3 days. So I have, at that time, I was doing a treadmill, so I was going to go on my marathon treadmill run thing. And I go out to the treadmill, and next to the treadmill is my son's weight bench. And on her weight bench is a driver's license, you know, and there's information on, love information. And this woman lives in Glendora, California. Her birth date's on here. Frick, she's 32 years old. I decide in 10 seconds or less, she's been in my house over the weekend, had sex with my 19-year-old kid, has two kids of her own, wants to marry him and call me mom. I am all over that, you know. And I run into the house and I show the driver's license to Butch and nothing, because that man has no imagination whatsoever. And so he tells me I'm crazy, you're a lunatic, whatever, you know, call Carol, because Carol's now been my sponsor for quite a while. And I call Carol, and, you know, and Carol rarely gives me specific direction, but that day she told me to shut up, shut up. She goes, you know, I know you are scared for this kid. She goes, but you know what, Larsine, it takes just as much energy to send good thoughts his way as negative ones. So why don't you pray for him instead of thinking up more crap in your stupid head about what you think happened over the weekend? And I end my conversation, as I often do with Carol, never mind, because I know I've been coming for a long time. But you know how it is. You know, when you're by yourself, it's a spooky place in there. So as it turns out, 2 days, I don't see my son, his schoolwork schedule, my work schedule. He comes in the garage like, you know, 2 days, or he comes into that kitchen, rather, 2 days later, and he's bringing the driver's license with him. And he says, Mom, what do you do when you find a driver's license? Well, I don't tell him what I do when I find a driver's license. Oh, that's a bad example. It's a bad, bad, bad example, you know. And people keep going, why do you come down when I'm Larsine? 10 seconds alone in the garage keeps me coming week after week after week after week. Because I will go to the dark side, information from nowhere, and I will run with that. But when I take it to you, you just show me a different way to look at it and give me the shot at a good life if I choose to take it, or I can live in pain and fear. And fear is the worst. Fear is the absolute worst. It is. And I know, and for you people that have, you know, people out there that are still doing the deal, and I know the fear, you know, but someone told me what fear stands for, and it's forgetting everything's all right. You know, and that's just kind of really what I hang in. Is everything okay right now? Then just go with that and just say a prayer for that person. And no one can guarantee what's going to happen or not happen. But I'm here to tell you, if love could fix some boy, we wouldn't, none of us need to be in these rooms. So we love them unconditionally no matter what. That's the big lesson. That's the thing that we all have to take home with us. And I don't care if you're an AAN and Al-Anon. If you're here and you're enjoying this fellowship, but you're going home and you're acting like a butt, you better do something about it. Because the real ride here is taking it home. Trust me, that's the real, real ride. A few years back, I found out I was going to be a grandma, specifically 8 years ago, thrilled about a grandma. Never been a grandma before. Don't have an index card for grandma, so I made one up on the spot. You know. And first thing on the card is, I must be there when the baby's born. Don't ask me why. I just had to be there, you know. And so, but as it turns out, you know, it's 9 months till the baby's going to be born, because, you know, they got popsicle sticks, so they know right away when this baby's coming. And so it turns out I have commitments all around this weekend that this baby's born, like four of them in a row. And so my husband says, well, you might want to get out of these commitments if the baby's going to be born, you know, and you, because you might miss it if you're gone. And I'm like, and you want to be here when the baby's born. And I'm like, I'm not going to miss those commitments. Those are Al-Anon commitments. I'm going to honor those commitments. And he goes, well, you might not be here when the baby's going to be born. You know, don't you like it now when the alcoholic is the voice of reason in your freaking house, man? You really need Al-Anon then, let me tell you. You have to go a lot of meetings, so... But anyway, he said you should discuss with Carol. And I told him I would, but I lied, you know, because I knew Carol would just be along with Butch as well. And, you know, and I didn't share with my home group because I knew my home group would rat me out to Carol, so that's no good either. You know, so I went right to God with my prayer, you know, and that's God, I know I'm not supposed to pray for specific things, and you know I never do. But this isn't really a thing. This is a baby being born. So I'm just asking for the baby not to be born on a Saturday or a Sunday. I can deal with anything else, but just not that. You know, and I see God's face in my mind as clear as that day. Larson, you do a lot of service. Boy, I'm with him. You got this one, girlfriend. You know, and because that's how I am with God now. And so anyway, everything comes and goes. Nothing, no baby, no baby. Last commitment I have. And I call my daughter-in-law Friday morning. Nothing going on. Okay, I'll see you Sunday. Get on this plane, go someplace in Minnesota. I'm at this Friday night dinner. My cell phone rings, and the baby has been born. I am so pissed. I can't even begin to tell you people how angry I am. And I'm at this dinner, and they're all, oh, we're so happy you're here. And I'm like, I hate you. You know, of course... That's not what's, of course, the outside looks wonderful, but that's what's on the inside. I am dying. So I run outside because, you know, I have tools of the program. I call Carol. I am in so much pain. God, this sucks. When do you get to be there for your family? I ask God for one little weeny baby not to be born on one freaking weekend. And is God there for me? No. I'm quitting Al-Anon. And I'll never forget this. I'm in so much pain. And Carol goes, I'll have to call you back. Oh, thank you. Thank you. More gravy for Larsing, right? Mind you, this is like 22 years in Al-Anon, and I'll never forget it, like a minute less, you know, and my cell phone rings. Now, I'm sorry, I don't know how it is here in Omaha, Nebraska, but I'm telling you, when your sponsor calls you, you have crossed the line, boy. They are bringing in the big guns to reel you back in. And that is exactly what happened. I had freaked out Carol so much, she had to call her sponsor. And then there's Charlotte's sweet voice on the... Now, I know better than yell at Charlotte, so I go the other way. I really wanted to be there when the baby was born. Feel sorry for me, pity. And I'll never forget her. She goes, Larsing, a beautiful, wonderful thing happened to you today. You became a grandmother, and because you made some ridiculous rule about how you thought it had to go down, you're going to take this beautiful event and turn it into a piece of crap? And one more thing. Did you turn your will and your life over to the care of God today? You know I did. Because I tell you, no matter what is going on with my life, I don't care where I am or how busy I am, it takes such a little amount of time every single day to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. If you just want to take that 3.5 seconds, that you need to do that. And I do that every single day. Then she said, if you did that, then you are exactly where you are supposed to be, doing exactly what you are supposed to be doing. And again, never mind. And I hang up the phone. And, you know, and what I remember now about that day is coming home on Sunday and my husband picking me up from the airport and taking me to the airport and holding that beautiful baby boy in my arms. That's my memory today. But left to my own devices, 22 years in Al-Anon, I would have turned it into a piece of crap. You know, when I lead a meeting, my topic is always what stick is up your butt. You know, because I'm telling you, if you stay rigid, you will break. You know, and we make all these rules, and we think everybody's supposed to be filling in, you know, and the boundary thing and all this stuff. Well, I'm here to tell you, love doesn't have a boundary. You know, God doesn't have a boundary. Faith doesn't have a boundary. Al-Anon doesn't have a boundary. None of those things are here. You know, it's unconditional love for each other. And when you're having stuff going on in your life and you take it to other people, they just give you the shot at a good life if you so choose to take it. You know, and that's just been totally my experience. The last, you know, when we found out that we were going to have Matt, my husband also discovered that he had developed cirrhosis of the liver as a result of his hepatitis C, and he did interferon for a year, and it didn't, you know, he's a sustained responder when he's on it, then he went off, then it came right back up again, then he had it for a year and a half, and now he hasn't had anything for the last 3 years, and now he's just this last month started the new interferon. They got the new treatment out now, and he's been having a really, really rough time of it. It's only been the first month, but he's just been really, really sick and not doing as well as I would like him to be doing, and now he's had to add this new drug, which is called Victrilis, which I keep calling Viagra, and he's got to take 12 pills a day. Woohoo! And he keeps telling me, no wonder I'm so tired. And but, you know, I don't know where that's going to take us or where that's going to go with us or whatever. But, you know, when it didn't work the first time, I was okay with it. But, boy, when it didn't work the second time, I was pissed again. I'm so angry at God. You know, all these people praying for him. We're doing everything we're supposed to be doing. You know, and I was in, and I remember just talking to a long-timer that was an Alcoholics Anonymous. Who, you know, he just told me, he goes, you know, God hears every single prayer you say. Every single prayer you say, and he is with you on this road 150%. And he's put all these people in your life so you don't have to do this journey by yourself. We're all eventually headed out one way or the other. But do you want to miss what's going on in your life right now? The joy, the grandkids, the fact that he is doing okay today because of your fear about what is eventually going to happen to all of us at some point in time. You know, and again, he gave me a very precious gift, the gift of right here, right now. Do not miss it. You know, and because of that, you know, we're just on the journey, and we're able to laugh, you know, and even though it's kind of been hard to laugh this last month because it has been really, really rough, you know, my husband is alcoholic. He takes advantage of me every flaming chance he gets because when he's been especially, especially sick, like the last, just before I came here, he wanted a drink of water, so I got him a drink of water, and he took a couple sips of it, and then he handed it back to me. He goes, can I have some more, and in a clean glass, you know, and so I don't know because he's so sick, and then he just, you know, and then he and then he says to me, maybe when you're in the program for 32 years, you won't fall for that as easy as you do at 30. And so we get to, you know, we get to have a shot at a good life, you know, and I can't thank you guys enough for that. I have a little wooden candle that I keep in my kitchen. It says a candle loses nothing of its light by lighting another candle. I want to thank you guys from the bottom of my heart for lighting my candle. Thanks for having me.